Welcome, Andy. This is Mr. Andy Sacker, our first interview on the podcast.
You saved me for the first.
Yes, the best for the first.
Yes.
Andy has played in the Burlington music scene for quite some time, transplant from Chicago, and welcome.
Thanks, Bob. I think you're doing this whole thing, and I know other people that you've asked to do it, and it's a great idea, and I think that everybody here in Vermont who has any association with bluegrass music agrees on that someone is actually doing this. And I know you're going to get Danny Cohn in here, and he's like, you know, he'll be the greatest interview you'll ever do, because he's the Danny Cohn. He's the guy, and he's also has an encyclopedic memory, and I have a touch of that, maybe.
I think it's going to be interesting, and I think it's going to give people a great understanding, and you know, there's just so much great music. You guys are my heroes, and this is my way of giving back, so everybody else for generations will be able to know about Mr. Andy Sacker. So, tell me about yourself. When were you born? I know age is might be a touchy thing, but when were you born,
brother?
That's
not touchy. I mean, I was born in 1945.
Yeah.
July 28th, 9 days before Hiroshima. I used to call myself the atomic baby, dropped out of the belly of the Enola Gay as it flew over Hiroshima. It's an ugly image, but...
So where were you born?
I was born in Cleveland, Ohio, and my family moved to Chicago when I was 2 months old, so I didn't have much of a life as a Clevelander, aside from trips back there to see grandparents, cousins, and all that stuff, aunts and uncles. And we moved to Chicago. We actually moved to a city that or a suburb initially that's in the very sad news today, to Highland Park, Illinois. And we moved there in the September of 45. We ended up there because my parents were the first house that they wanted to buy was in, I think, the northwestern suburb, I think Glenview, although I'm not positive of that, and I don't want to badmouth them. I know it's not the same, but they were refused. The realtor said, we don't, he when he asked their names, he said, are you Jews?
Wow.
And we were Jews, and so they said, well, sorry, you can't live in this community. And that kind of stuff was going on. It's been it's been there.
How old were you then?
Well, I was 2 months old.
2 months old.
Yeah, I was just born.
Wow.
But anyway, so we moved to Highland Park, and we were there for about 4 years, and we moved into the city. My father's financial circumstances took a big hit. And I had to sell his house, sell their house. And we moved into the north side of the city, a part of the city called West Rogers Park, and stayed in that neighborhood all through childhood. We moved, when I was in about the sixth grade, we moved one block away to an older building, but a bigger three-bedroom.
Now, for people who don't know, where is North Rogers Park? Is it north side?
No, by the far north side.
Okay.
6200 north.
Okay.
I think the northern border of Chicago is where it meets up with Evanston, which is the first of the suburbs, and this is about 20 or 25 blocks south of that of that line. So the far north side of the city. It's a good neighborhood. yeah. Stayed there right through high school.
So how many in your family? Brothers and sisters?
Just my brother. Just one brother. Steven's 3.5 years older than me.
And is he still in Chicago?
No, he hasn't been in Chicago for many decades. He left, went right from law school and moved to D.C.
Interesting.
He's a lawyer. He was a lawyer. He's retired now. And that's what he did.
And I own one of his jackets.
You own one of his jackets?
Yeah, didn't you give me one of his jackets?
Oh, yeah. That's right.
So it really kind of goes without saying.
It's a very large jacket.
Yeah. It's actually getting big on me now.
Well, that's good.
Yeah. So I know the answer to this question, but I know everybody would love to know if you were a Cubbies fan or a White Sox fan.
As are most North Siders in Chicago, I'm a Cubs fan. The Sox are on the South Side. And so I was a Cubs fan. I'm still a Cubs fan, I guess. They're once again being their pathetic selves after that crazy year, whenever it was, a few years back when they won the World Series, which I never thought I'd live to see.
And you did.
And they did, yeah.
Now, speaking of that, when you were a kid, did you get to go to any Cubbies games?
Oh, yeah.
Tell me about that. Was it fun?
Yeah, it was always fun to go there. I mean, we didn't go a lot, but we went. The last, what is that?
I think it's somebody's phone. Your phone, Andy.
Oh, it's my phone. Oh, it's a valid number, but goodbye. Sorry.
That's okay.
The last Cubs game I went to, the fall of 74, and I officially moved to Vermont in the summer of 75. But that last fall, I went. The last Cub games I saw then was Ferguson Jenkins' last game pitching for the Cubs. He was a pretty good pitcher.
I remember.
And he went to play with at least one or two other teams. And I've been back to Wrigley maybe three times in the last 10 years. I still have a couple of friends, about three, that I keep in touch with who are in Chicago.
So let's move on to what people really want to know. And that is, as a musician, what inspired you?
Well,
and what year did you start playing a musical instrument?
I love music and listen to it a lot, like everyone did. And the music that I listened to was strictly mundane. It was just, you know, I listened to the radio. I listened to the birth of rock and roll, at least as it got to the masses. I certainly never heard any of the, you know, like Sister Rosetta Tharpe, who is that her name? Who they say was the first rock and roller in the late 40s. But I remember Elvis Presley coming on, and I enjoyed a lot. I enjoyed whatever music I heard. I liked things, you know, my parents' era, the big band music, and whatever crap that they played on the radio in those days. It was just, you know, everything from everything.
So
everything from music from the 20s music that was in the old movies. We did have one folk music album when I was a boy, and it was a Burl Ives album. He was a folk singer who became an actor and was pretty good. I think he you can catch him in a film called Cat on a Hot Tin Roof that Paul Newman made when he was in his 20s, early 20s maybe. And anyway, Burl Ives was a folk singer, but I didn't know. I guess that's what I knew about folk music was Burl Ives. But we just had one record. That's all. It was an LP. But when the rock and roll started playing, I liked it. I liked lots of it. Listened to it. Used to, had a radio by my bedside, and I'd spin that dial late at night. And there were always stations to listen to, and I liked it. And the first instrument I played, was in a school. My school started offering instrumental instruction when I was maybe in the fourth grade or fifth grade. I don't remember exactly. And I wanted to play the French horn because I liked the sound of it on albums.
Wind instrument
albums. And when the teacher came. Or when we went to his, whatever it was, when he asked us what we wanted to play, and I said, I'd like to play the French horn. He said, no, you're going to play the French horn. I'll give you a clarinet. So I had a clarinet, and it was kind of a struggle to learn to play, and of course you're taught to learn to read and play, and I had never... That was the first and last, really, experience where I actually was trying to read music, I guess. Well, I did a little bit later on. But I got to the point where I could play Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star on that clarinet. And
now, didn't Benny Goodman play the clarinet?
He sure did.
There you go.
And I have a link to Benny Goodman when... the first job that I had after college, I taught elementary school on the west side of Chicago. Did it for 5 years. It was kind of it was an alternative service to going to Vietnam. The local draft boards were urged to give an occupational deferment to young men who were willing to teach in the dangerous neighborhoods bad neighborhoods. And the year I finished college, which was 67, that summer, there were some 1,000 or 1,100 vacancies in the Chicago public schools. Now, I think there were like 36,000 teachers or something like that. They had a lot of big school district. And they were accepting anyone who had a degree in anything. I never intended to be a teacher. My mother was a teacher all her life. She was a taught high school French in a suburban high school. They gave you this deferment from the draft, and it seemed like a good idea. I knew I didn't really want to go to Vietnam, and so that's what I did. I taught in an elementary school on the west side near Roosevelt Road and California Street. It was a very bad neighborhood, I guess.
Did you teach multiple subjects or just one?
Elementary. I taught everything except gym and library. I taught everything. I think I had the kids... I had them all day long. They were probably sick of listening to my voice.
It's kind of a hard voice to get sick of.
And anyway, as to your question about what's his name? The clarinetist.
Benny Goodman.
The neighborhood that this school was, it was a Henry O. Shepherd Elementary School. And pre-World War II, it had been an all-Jewish neighborhood. The old West Side, it was, you know, Jews who were largely of immigrant families, I guess, and maybe some first generation born in America were there too.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, his family lived there, and he lived there, and he went to school there. And his parents owned the little school store that was right kitty corner from the school playground.
Interesting.
Benny Goodman. Anyway, yeah, you asked about him. But the clarinet, I didn't play it for very long. I might have tried for a few months, and then I wasn't a very fiercely determined in a lot of ways, I think. My mother wanted me to pursue art because I used to draw a lot. I didn't know that. But I don't know. The things that were the least bit scary to me, I just figured I'm better off just avoiding them. And the music was, it just wasn't that interesting. It wasn't that interesting.
So you moved from clarinet to something
else? Well, the first thing, my brother Steve, when he was maybe 13, or 12 or 13, somewhere around there, got a guitar, a Sears Silvertone archtop guitar.
Wow.
And, it was probably a $30 or $40 instrument. And so I'm not sure how old I was when I started, 11, 12, I don't know. I banged on this Sears Silvertone guitar, and I didn't know what I was doing, I don't think he showed me anything. I don't know how much he learned, to tell you the truth. He learned chords, I guess. He learned basic chords. And but I did start playing the guitar in a more serious nature in 1959, when the folk music boom, the folk boom, I guess it was called, began with the Kingston Trio. 1959, I think they had their first hit that was on made the charts, so it was played a lot on the radio, and it was Tom Dooley. There, hang down your head, Tom Dooley, hang down your head and cry. And I liked it, and as did many people in my generation, and other generations, maybe older people too.
And that was a different sound at that time?
Well, it was, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it sounded to me way better than the Burl Ives record sounded that probably was released, I don't know, was made in 1954 or 5. I'm just guessing at that. They were accepted pretty quickly, and then they had these great records, and they were live at the Hungry Eye and the San Francisco nightclub, and they were cool, and they were hip, and they were funny. They were really funny, and they really appealed to, I think, the college crowd. And I was far from college in 1959. That was the year I started high school. But they were, their humor was funny, and I just liked them. You know, I had three or four or five of their records, and then I began playing the guitar with a more serious attitude, I guess.
Were you trying to play their songs?
Yeah. Oh yeah. And my brother had purchased a tenor guitar, a Martin tenor guitar with a mahogany top. It sounds like a lot. And somehow he talked my parents into getting it for him, I guess, because I don't think he got it himself. And he took it off to college when he went to college, so that was whatever that was. 59, I guess 1960 or 61, he went to college in Madison, Wisconsin. And he had the tenor guitar there, had a little frat house damage, lower side caved in, and he took it to had somebody repair it professionally. It was prepared. It was fixed very nicely. Anyway, that's what I played, and by that time I was, I guess maybe the Kingston Trio had faded a little bit. I was listening to Joan Baez. I liked her music a lot. She had this wonderful appeal. You know, this gorgeous, simply gorgeous voice, and I liked her material. And little did I know, her material was probably a bit more traditional in some ways than the Kingston Trio. The Kingston Trio took traditional songs and then schmaltzed them up. They just, yeah. But I liked her stuff, and probably the first, maybe the first bluegrass I ever heard was on her, I think, her second album. And she had maybe two or three cuts with the Greenbrier Boys, which was this New York City bluegrass band. Bob Yellen was a member of this band.
Which you ended up playing with in years.
Yeah,
well, since.
I met him. Yeah, it was. Yeah. Yeah, he moved up to Vermont some years in the 80s. I think that was the first bluegrass I really heard. And it was, she probably sang, Little Darling Pal of Mine, you know, you are my little darling, oh, how I love you, and I can tell.
So they backed her up?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And so I was listening to Joan Baez and Peter Paul and Mary and the like, the Limelighters. You know, commercial folk music, really. And Joan Baez was too, I guess. Maybe she was a little bit apart from those traditional commercial bands, but I started getting together with a friend in high school, a guy named Steve Kaufman, who had a classical guitar, you know, a nylon string guitar, and he and we would get together and play. It was fun, I played with a thumb pick and a finger pick. I would pluck a lower string and scratch across with my finger, kind of a Carter
Stanley,
but the Carter family, like Maybelle Carter.
Oh, Maybelle, yeah, yeah.
You know, I actually didn't know about that at all yet. But probably in my third year of high school, I became friends with two guys who were in high school with me. They were both a year younger than me, and they were both young folk musicians. They were taking lessons at the Old Town School of Folk Music.
Which was in Chicago?
It was in Chicago. It was a already fairly well known, and it still exists. It's it moved two or three times, and it's still there in a much larger setting. But it was kids would go on Saturday mornings, and there would be an a beginner's guitar class, a beginner's banjo class, a beginner's, I don't know what they had. I never actually took lessons there, but I used to, in my last year of high school, probably, I would go down on Saturday afternoons, and we would kind of hang out there. After the classes ended, there would be they would all gather in a big room, and there was a stage, and any traveling act that went through town that was folk music, they would try to get them to come in and do a few songs. And when I was 17, 18, 62 or 3, I guess. Doc Watson came in and played there. Did like a maybe a 20-minute show. And who else did I see there? Ian Tyson and Sylvia. Ian and Sylvia with a third person who played the mandolin. I don't remember who it was. They did one of those shows. They had this amazing old banjo player named Gus Cannon, who was at the time he played there in 1962 or three. He was probably 85 years old.
Wow!
And he was a minstrel. Came out of that tradition of minstrelsy.
Which means can play multiple instruments and entertain?
Well, he was definitely an entertainer. I think he just played the banjo, as far as I know. But his playing the banjo was a show.
Okay.
And he did a few songs, and he wrote one song that is enduring, part of the major American folk heritage, but and I can't think of the name of it right now. But what I remember seeing him do was he did a couple songs, just sat on a stool and played. And then he got the last song he did, he started getting the banjo. He was holding the banjo up, like supporting it under the peg head, and with his hands, and letting it hang from him, and he started swinging it
like a pendulum.
And it would swing back and forth, and he'd get the chord in with his other hand, reach around and play the chord as it swung by. He just had his hand there, and then he started bringing the banjo around, and he'd swing it under his leg, and he'd catch it with the other arm and grab it by the neck, and still hitting the chords. As he had like an open tune. He was probably doing a song in C, and then he'd do it through the other leg, and it was pretty amazing to see.
Anyway, so you were still playing guitar at that point?
Oh yeah, I was playing guitar, and we used to just hang out out there, and we'd go where the classes were at the Old Town School. When the classes were on, before they had this thing in the big room, we used to go in the men's room and play, which really sounded great. We liked
the echo.
It had these enormous urinals that were like head high and to the floor,
made for giants.
And they were just these big old fashioned, and the sound was kind of good in that bathroom. Anyway, but. Yeah.
So when all this time you're working on getting proficient at playing folk music and inspired by some really great bands, and then at a certain point in probably 63, I'm guessing, you switched to mandolin and
not yet. And I first heard bluegrass around that time, and through these two guys, Paul Ostroff and Larry Robin, were their names. And I don't remember who had the album, but heard a Country Gentleman album, and the Country Gentlemen were somewhat akin to the Kingston Trio, because they were kind of the hipsters of the bluegrass world, and they were in the Washington D.C. area. They were not, didn't grow up in the Appalachians, and they were not exactly hillbillies like the Stanley Brothers and Flat Scruggs and Bill Monroe, and Monroe was Western Kentucky, but they were different. They had kind of a citified way about them, and they would do clever things with the music, and they would and they were great. I thought they were the first band I fell in love with, and that's what grabbed me into the bluegrass.
So that the Country Gentlemen went through a number of transitions with a number of different musicians.
Yeah, this was the original. I think
who was in that band?
It was John Duffy and Charlie Waller on guitar, and Eddie Adcock
on banjo,
and the bass player was can't think of his name. He actually, I think he lived in Vermont for a while, much, much later. And I think he had a job at the, Smithsonian or something. They were decent here. Mm-hmm. They played, my friends Willie and Dan Linder, who grew up in the Baltimore area, Willie used to go to see the Country Gentlemen play at the Shamrock on M Street in Georgetown, which is where they played. They were the one night a week regulars there, and he used to go see them before he was old enough to get in there. And anyway, they had this appeal that I really liked, and they're the ones who really made me fall in love with the music. And around the same time, it was 63, I think, the Beverly Hillbillies theme song, that show came on the air sometime around then. Flat and Scruggs playing mm-hmm. that song. And that probably was instrumental in bringing bluegrass to the attention of many people.
Right.
And there was a whole mess of people who were not unlike me, who lived in northern urban people or western urban people in Berkeley and San Francisco and LA, wherever, who had no cultural stake in the music of the Southern Appalachians, but heard this bluegrass sound, and it just grabbed onto you. And some people were into it for a while and went away musically, but for a lot of us, it's lasted a lifetime. I don't know if there's something. Something in me that fell for it.
Did you, when you were tooling around the radio dial at night, I know every once in a while myself on my little transistor radio, I would be fortunate enough to pick up WSM, the Grand Ole Opry, and that made a huge impact on me.
Yeah, and I was a lot closer to that radio station in Chicago. I don't know, it's 500 miles maybe, or 400. I don't know exactly what it is. Yeah, that would. And I never had heard that. I don't think I ever. Well, but I take it back. There was a country show on TV in Chicago. It was the WGN Barn Dance. WGN was the Channel 9. That was the Cubs network. That was the network that people throughout the Midwest knew as the Cubs. Cubs country like Red Sox country is all of New England, but the Cubs, Iowa and Wisconsin and Minnesota, before the expansion teams moved up, went into those areas, it was Cubs. It was solid the Cub world. Anyway, but yeah, I in my early years of listening to bluegrass, I also started listening to country music, and my good friend Bob Hoban, who I met when I was 18, I guess, and I think Bob was a year younger than me. He had dropped out of high school. He was Bob is no longer around. He died about 4 or 5 years ago. He was quite an amazing person and an amazing musician. And but he was really into bluegrass. I remember the first time he and I sang a song together, it was like, wow, this really works. Some Stanley Brothers song that we both knew, whatever it was. And but now I lost my track. What was I talking about?
Well, you were talking about the country barn dance.
I said that I started listening to country, and Hoban was also interested in the country sound, and I guess he kind of turned me on to it, and. He loved Buck Owens. Buck Owens was great then. It was like it was kind of raw country music. It was nothing like the Nashville sound. This was the Bakersfield sound. And the Buck Owens, his band was a five piece band: pedal steel, bass,
drums,
rhythm guitar, drums, and but Buck played mostly just the rhythm guitar, although he was also could play lead, and then he had a guy named Don Rich, was his tenor singer and the lead guitarist, and they both played Fenders, electric guitars, but their sound was great, and I like that music to this day, just 2 days ago, listening to my wife Anna's, one of her CDs that she had bought, the Vince Gill album called Bakersfield, where the other great country singer in Bakersfield was Merle Haggard. He's from the same place, So Vince Gill did this album, first song Buck Owens, next song a Merle Haggard song, and of course Vince Gill is one of the great vocalists all time and guitarist.
Pretty darn good picker,
and he
too.
And he did this album with Paul Franklin on pedal steel, who is fantastic. They do Together Again, and the pedal steel will make your heart soar. You listen to it. I don't mean S-O-A-R, make your heart soar, not S-O-R-E.
Like painful.
Yeah, not painful. It makes your heart fly.
Well, why don't we stop right there and take a break, and we'll be back in a little bit with more information on Andy Sacker and his bluegrass journey.